free audio post-production by Alphonic.com.
Welcome to Deep Dive Genre. Rahman Jafari is an illustrator, animator, and filmmaker working in both 2D and 3D, currently living in Berlin, Germany. Through colorful imagery and fragmented narratives, they are hoping to reach into a realm of honest emotionality and willful fragility, creating surreal worlds and characters that oscillate between the familiar and the fantastical. With a background in illustration and design, Rahman ventured into animation, filmmaking, and music videos, expanding his practice and toolset from project to project. They have directed music videos for artists across the world, working with labels such as Universal, Warp Records, and Downtown Records, as well as other clients like Adult Swim, Medium, and The New Yorker. We talked to Rahman via video call for this interview. Hi, Rahman. Welcome to Deep Dive Genre. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. You are a director, animator, and illustrator who uses a lot of different visual styles and mediums. And I'm really looking forward to having a conversation with you today. I'd like to start off with a few general questions. Can you tell us a bit more about your journey to becoming an animation artist and director?
My becoming an animation director was a bit of a coincidence. Like, I always wanted to do some kind of visual art. When I was a child, I was always drawing. There was a bit like my home, the place that I would retreat into. And I identified also a lot with this moniker of being somebody that draws. That was a big part of, I think, my identity. And then I had like a phase where I was really into graffiti. Then I discovered digital painting and concept art, and I got really fascinated in like learning academic like painting and drawing. So when I was in high school still, I already started doing like master studies and trying to paint like from like copy Rembrandt paintings or do still lifes and stuff. And I was just really into like becoming really good at the draftsmanship of like classical image making. And then I started studying illustration in Hamburg, and I tried a lot of different things while I was studying there. I financed my studies by being a concept artist and character designer for video games. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of my studies, friends of mine who became this big techno group, they called FIAC, they asked me to do a music video for them. And I had never done any animation before, and also had never, like maybe I'd done like a small GIF or something, but I'd never really like practiced anything. I didn't have any skill or any thought about how to animate. And also I never thought about film really as a form of expression. So I couldn't really envision what an edit would be or like how to think about an idea of a camera.
Yeah.
Especially if you do animation, like it's not even that you can point a camera anywhere. Like you have to think about what a camera would be in a space that doesn't exist. So then I just learned all or tried to learn as much as I could while I was making this first music video of mine. And I really liked the outcome, even though the process was very painful and overwhelming and stressful because I didn't know how to do anything. But after the release, like the feedback was just really good. And I was really proud of what I'd done. And I kind of fell in love with all of these new possibilities. And from there, I just kept going. I got another gig for a music video, then I did another one. Then I did some smaller projects that were music videos. And I started to direct for like a London-based production company called Blink Inc. And yeah, no, that's kind of my life.
How do you, well, obviously sometimes projects come to you, but how do you choose which stories to tell or which projects to take? And I'm skipping ahead to the next question. How do you then decide what kind of visual style you use? Because obviously sometimes the, you know, musical artists have some ideas, but I mean, you are the visual artist, so...
I think in the beginning, there wasn't that much of a conscious choice, just because I felt like I had to catch up in a way. I joined like a world that I didn't know anything about. And I was just so lucky that I got to partake in it, especially when I started to go to my first film festivals. I was like, wow, I want to do more.
Yeah.
All of the projects that came to me, I would just do. And it was mostly music videos in the beginning. And then after time got more scarce. And also when my first couple of like commercial, like advertisement jobs knocked on the door, I started to struggle a bit more with this choice. Like in the beginning, I think I had a very strict policy. I just rejected all commercial jobs, like advertisement jobs, because I didn't have any, I had no financial pressures back then because I was had like $300 rent and no health insurance cost. And also like my practice was very, it still is very fragile and vulnerable, I think. And it felt somehow, yeah, it felt bad to give this to something that is not culture. Like in music videos, I always felt like I was contributing to culture and I didn't want to do advertisement. And then, yeah, I think over time, this line became a bit more blurry to me. Also because I think I realized like, if I want to make my own work and start writing and start, try to make narrative work, I need a bit more time and headspace. And then I just started to kind of doing it case by case. Like I think sitting in the discomfort of always needing to make this choice of which jobs do you take and which don't you take is part of the job, which nobody really talks about. It's kind of just assumed that you know what you should do, and it's really hard. And I think for me, it's if it's music videos, it's like either I really need to like the music, I think. And if the music speaks to me, then I have the time, I want to do it. Then, of course, there are jobs where maybe I don't love the music so much, but it just feels a bit like it's an opportunity you can't reject. You know, if it's like, wow, this is like a big opportunity for somebody who never had even the ambition to become a director, and now I get these jobs. And that's, quite frankly, sometimes the case. And then sometimes also, of course, like making money can be an incentive that is like, yeah, if you need money and you don't have any savings anymore, or you are hoping to build savings and you want to get some free time, like, yeah, I think every time I get a job, I struggle. My desire to do certain things has shifted over the years. Like right now, for example, I just try to make time to finish my short film that I'm working on at the moment and write. I started writing a feature, but who knows if that will ever happen. But I just, like, for me right now, I try to just make as much time as I can for my own work, which then, of course, influences questions of do you take a job or not. And regarding the visual style and the visual language, sorry, this is also what you asked about. I feel like that's very intuitive for me. Like, often it's just when I, like, let's say for a music video, when I hear a song, I just start to see stuff in my head. Mm-hmm. And based on what I'm seeing, I do a lot of research also in the beginning. It's like, it can be visual research, it can be also just research and just reading texts that I feel like speak to themes that I feel like relate to the music. Sometimes it's also research and like reaching out to other people I would like to collaborate with.
Animation is not an easy genre to begin with. You know, we're talking budget, production times, target audience. I was wondering how this influences your decision in regards to the visuals and the cinematography, or maybe it doesn't influence your decisions at all.
No, it does quite a lot. Like, I used to, in the beginning, I just did everything by myself. Like, when I started doing animation, I was 25 or 24, I think. And the only limit on resource was my own time, and I would just exploit myself, like, mercilessly, which in hindsight, like, I also remember it was really painful. Like, it wasn't painful in this, even just like, oh, thinking about what I could have done. Just like, it was physically, like, very draining. Like, I would work, like, 14, 15 hours sometimes because I was so afraid that, like, I had no financial backing from my parents, and I really wanted to do it. Yeah. So I felt like I have these opportunities, like I really need to take them. And I just worked hours that are not sustainable at all. And I burnt myself out, I think, already when I was like 25, 26. I was really, really like had anxiety attacks and stuff. So in the beginning, that was the only constraint. I would just try to envision something and try to find out how to make it. Then later, it started when I started collaborating with people. It was also just trying to think more from like a directorial perspective. There was a time when I co-directed with Daniel Almagor, and like there was the idea that we would just try to spend all of the money that we got to get people on the project and make something that we couldn't do ourselves. Mm-hmm. And now, but again, with tiny budgets, like where everybody would work for almost nothing, but it was a lot of money still for us. Like there was no, even not no desire to get the living wage out of it. It was just so cool to get money for this. And then I think when I started directing for Blink Inc., which is this production company in London, there I had the first time an encounter with like how do you calculate and professional budgets. And there would often be a conversation with the producer of like, this is what I'm seeing in my head. What do you think as the producer we can afford to do? And then it is often a negotiation of what can I compensate with my own skill? And I can do quite a bit. Like I can do a lot of different things in terms of anime. I can do compositing, I can do 3D, I can do 2D, I can light the scene, I can do camera work, I can storyboard, like, yeah. So I can also take jobs that maybe you would have to pay other people for. I would just basically do them for free as a director. The more budget there is, the bigger you will start to dream and start to do things that I can't do myself.
Yeah.
Like I just did the project where I directed stop motion for the first time. Mm-hmm. And because I have no infrastructure to do my own stop motion stuff, we needed enough budget so that we could just get a crew and a set and stuff to finance it. And that was possible. So I was like, I want to do stop motion because the money allows us to do it.
Your video, you know, the Dua Lipa and Elton John duet, obviously garnered a lot of attention. Can you tell us a little bit more about the idea behind it and your creative choices?
When I got this job back then, I was really at that point of being really burnt out, I think. Like I was not only just because of the work, which was also a big part of it. I did these crazy hours at this time. Mm-hmm. But it was also just the feeling that if you are working as a freelance director in commissioned work, it's the process of pitching is really brutal. It's like just from a labor perspective, it's really fucked up, actually. It's just this thing of like you are just asked to work for free, provide ideas for free, mm-hmm. to people who might not even care to answer you. Like I just like to talk about it because it's a big part of this job of a freelance director. Like you just do a lot of unpaid labor. And because you're a director, I think people kind of have this glamorous view of it. And of course, you get a lot of acknowledgement and that's really great. But there are big labels and big companies or agencies and they just ask you to work for free. And if you don't do it, you don't get a job. So I was at this point where I felt a bit broken by it. I felt broken by the feeling of giving a lot of myself to projects and like writing pitches for music videos that really came from a very intimate place and pouring my heart out and then not even getting a response sometimes.
Yeah.
So when I got this job, opportunity to pitch on the Elton John video, I actually rejected it first because I was emotionally not ready to take another one of these hits. I was like, this feels really big and exciting, but it also feels a bit like an illusion. And if I will engage with this illusion emotionally, I'm risking to be hurt. And I couldn't take this at this moment. I felt a bit like, this is a bit too much. Like, I don't want to get excited for something that I won't get anyways. But in the end, I got convinced. And I said, like, okay, I will do it, but I will do it really quickly. Like, I will write this very small pitch. And the brief was, I think it was just super vague. It was something like a summer vibe and disco. So, like, just super. Okay. And I just had this, because a lot of my projects that I did before, they came from a place of pain. Even in my music video, or like, I did like a short poetry film back then. And like, they were all came from like my own struggle. And I wanted to make something that felt like joyful and light. And I don't know, like it also, I wanted something, if I would do it, it would be fun to do it, you know? And it would be like almost a guilty pleasure, indulgence and just fun visuals.
Yeah.
So I wrote this idea about these four friends who are like very fabulous and like, I don't know, cute to each other. And they had, I don't know, this feeling of like a chemistry that you have when you have a night out with good friends and like you feel a vibe in the room and you travel together for one night, and that they would summon by their joy, would summon like a universe around them that reflected that joy. And I put some like very lot of like glam rock, disco references in the treatment, a lot of like, I don't know, very strong glare on the images and like very bold, beautiful colors and like sparkling outfits and plateaus with glitter on the soul and stuff like this. And
yeah,
they just liked it. And music video turnarounds are super short. So
yeah,
after they signed it off, we just started directly, basically.
Yeah. How much time did you have to deliver?
I think it was 7 weeks, I think.
Cool. Okay. Yeah. That's very sportlich, as we say.
Very sportlich, yeah.
I also really loved your video for Pamphlets, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And for that also, I was just, I wanted to ask, like, how long did it take you to design that and animate the film? And how did this sort of like cool blue color palette come about?
Yeah, so I think like Pamphlets was the project I did right before the Elton John video. I got asked by Warp Records right after I had just put out like a very small poetry short film called I Want to Be the Ocean. And they saw that. And then they asked me to do something similar for the new release of Squid. And they were actually very, like, this was a really interesting original brief because they sent me a lot of material. Mm-hmm. Like Squid had, they sent me short stories that they had read while doing the album. They sent me visual references that they liked. And I really got into it. I read the stories. I looked at all of the references and I started to write the concept for a song. And while I was already very committed to this idea, mm-hmm. and then they said, oh, we're not doing it in the end. And I was like, oh, fuck, that's so sad.
Yeah.
Then they came back and they said, oh, we have another song, but now it's an 8-minute song, wow. which is like just very long for a music video.
Yeah.
And but it was for the same budget. And I was like, oh, fuck, I don't know if I should do this. This feels like it will burn me out. Mm-hmm. Just the length of it. And I wanted to do this one thing. We didn't do it in the end. And then 2 weeks later, I came with another thing, but the deadline didn't change. So I think in the end, the production was like 6 weeks or something.
Surprised. Okay.
And the budget was really small. Like it was a one-person budget, basically, mm-hmm. like, or maybe two. Like two if you want to pay both people an okay wage, I think. Yeah, and then I don't know, like in the end, I felt like the new song was very cool because it was so cinematic. It's like very long and it has like a lot of narrative beats because the song has so much range and it's not like structured like a pop song. So you have like, it's very operatic almost for a post-punk song. And then, yeah, I started to listen to the song a lot. And when you do a music video, at least for me, there's always something that sticks out in the beginning. And in this case, they have like a chorus line that they repeated. That's why I don't go outside. Mm-hmm. And for me, this was a line that just triggered a feeling inside of me that I, at this point in my life, I had to deal with a lot. Is I often, it will get very personal now. I often had the feeling in my life that I felt very unlovable and very wrong somehow. Like I felt like there was something rotten inside of me. And I was afraid that people would see me and perceive that, this wrongness. So I couldn't leave the house because I was so afraid to be perceived for this thing that feels so bad inside. At this time, I was in this phase of like trying to make peace with myself to some degree, make peace with my body, make peace with my biography. I started to go to therapy at this time.
Yeah.
I started to understand my own queerness and my own like sense of being in the world, and like I wanted to make something that speaks to this tension that I was feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I started to work around this theme, and I started to work with this idea of this beautiful beast that is trapped inside of a house because they can't leave the house, and there's something menacing and powerful and scary about them, but at the same time there's a vanity and there's a softness and there's a fragility. And I wanted to balance this against this antagonistic image of the outside, which to me was like, the outside is constructed normality that almost nobody can fit to, but that makes you feel wrong. Like you think everybody else fits, but you're the one that doesn't fit. So, and it was kind of like this golden age of Hollywood image that I had in my head, like, you know, like everybody in pinstripe suits and stuff like this. And then, and I got really inspired also for the outside by the images of Alex Prager, who really influenced me at this moment. Yeah, and then I started working, sketching, concepting. And for example, this light blue color palette, I think it came from, I saw like photos of David Bowie wearing this, it's called the ice blue suit designed by Freddie Beretti, which is like a very, just a blue suit that I felt like held an interesting sense of androgynousness in it because it was a suit, but it had a kind of feminine cut to the way the collar was cut and the...
Yeah, did they have like a bigger label?
Or? Yeah, exactly, yeah. And this I really liked a lot. And there was a photo series by Tim Walker where he photographed Tilda Swinton in these like surreal settings with a really short focal length and quite distorted. And I also really liked the feel of those.
Mm-hmm.
And these really influenced kind of the look of the interior, which was this kind of... It used to be a beautiful place, but it kind of got abandoned because the person inside can't take care of themselves and can't take care of the space. So yeah, that's where this image came from.
I just think it's really interesting to hear what all the creative processes that go on behind such a project. I mean, you mentioned it, you're working on your short film. And especially in regards to that, I think it's really fantastic that you're taking the time to talk to us. Is there anything you can tell us about the short film? Like a little bit, maybe genre, bits and pieces of the story, anything you want to tell, obviously, or have you decided on a visual style yet?
I think I can, because also, like, I think it's now there's like a little one image and like a description is online now. Mm-hmm. I'm doing it like it's a three-way co-production between Germany, France, and the UK.
Yeah.
And in Germany, it's Fabian and Fred.
Okay.
In France, it's Icky Films. And in the UK, it's Blink Industries. So, and I think Fabian and Fred, they just put something up on their website. So I think there's like glimpses in the world already. So it's fine. I think I didn't want to talk about it for a while, but I think I can talk about it now. Uh-huh. At least for now, it's called Throwing Sticks at the Sun. And it is an attempt, I think, to grasp with a lot of feelings that I experienced in my childhood, particularly around the idea of being socialized as a boy and what that does to you and like how you perceive these rules of engagement. And also, I think it started in the beginning because I always felt like when you see all of this whole like manosphere universe that has like been around for the last 10 years, but also just like the sheer thought of like all of these authoritarian figures, they used to be like children at some point. And these children, they experienced things that led them to become these people. Of course, it's more complex than just personal biographies. And I don't want to like trivialize these like oppressive structures that we live in. And it's more than just individuals, of course, totally. But I was still nonetheless curious about like, there are these people that become this at some point, but they weren't this, they were children. And I started to think about like, what were the moments where I experienced in my childhood, these moments where I felt like I was forced to change or had the choice if I wanted to change or not. Mm. And there were moments when I really felt like if I want to be loved, I need to kill something inside of myself because how I really feel has no space in this world. Like, I think this is when I started to very consciously observe this logic of patriarchy that I hadn't, of course, we had no words for this as children, but I felt something. I felt this thing of like, I am a certain way and this is not wanted. And you start to absorb these codes. And it's a lot about this. And it's also, I think, a time capsule of this. Kids, me and my friends in the early 2000s, all coming from different diasporic communities in Berlin, building a little bit our own universe of belonging and kind of creating shape that didn't exist. Like, I think this is also really interesting in general about, I don't know, like a lot of these waves of generations who grow up in Germany but have background somewhere else in the world, that we had to invent new ways of existing, new traditions that were influenced from our parents' heritage, but also German normal culture. Like here, that was from here. And then also just the subcultures we engaged with. So like, I don't know, Yu-Gi-Oh cards and rap music and I don't know, like a manga or something. Like I think that this also really fascinated me, like this idea of how did we create our own world?
Yeah.
All of this film is kind of living in this idea of struggle and pain, but also trying to forge belonging and trying to see how did we try to care for each other if we could or couldn't, and what would we have maybe needed to be able to care for each other. And
I always think it's very interesting also, like there's like a lot of code switching going on, like cultural code switching, and then, you know, sort of emotional social code switching as well, and there's so many layers. Do we have a timeline?
I hope I will finish this year. Like, I think we are on a good track.
Okay.
I think we should finish this year.
Our listeners can keep their eyes open for next year, and we'll definitely link to the page. Now, I have a few, well, I say rapid fire questions, but obviously you can take your time and answer as long or short as you want. In addition to your short film, you said you started writing a feature. Is there a particular story or genre or visual style that you would still like to tackle?
I don't know if I have like a super precise answer as usual to this. Like, I think, for example, this thing about like me writing a feature, it's more about I just want to write. Like, I don't even know if, like, it's less about that this would be a feature. I think I'm really trying to become a better writer at the moment. Okay. So the practice of writing is almost more important than the idea that this will be a film in the end.
Yeah, more about the process.
It's more about the process, I think. And I'm not one of these people that, as I said, like, I didn't dream of becoming a director. It wasn't like, I need to make a feature. It's more like, I'm just really happy that I get to discover all of this vastness of this medium, and also of the joy of learning how to work inside of this medium still after like now 8 years of directing.
Yeah.
And since I didn't go to film school, I felt like the last years of working was my film school. And now I'm slowly getting to the point where I can speak and I'm trying to learn how to use that voice.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think like after now I did my first time directing a stop motion project, I think I really want to do a stop motion short after this current short that I'm doing. I have two other shorts that I've written already.
Mm-hmm.
They were originally not meant to be stop motion. I think one of them I will try to maybe make it in stop motion. So yeah, that would be cool.
Nice. I talked to a stop motion artist 2 weeks ago, Mona Keil. She has like her own studio in Leipzig, Studio Animals. And she's doing a lot of interesting stuff. What would you say is the biggest misconception about the work of somebody who works in animation and illustration?
I mean, I think the obvious one is this thing that probably all animators say. It's like, people think it's for children, which, I mean, fair enough, right? Like in Germany, we didn't grow up with much animation catered to adults.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't even tell anybody that's wrong that they would think that. It's just like when you're not exposed to it, how would you know? But I think even beyond that is also, I think, even if people, let's say, they know Studio Ghibli and they realize these are films that are not only for children, they're like very adult, there's still, I think, an idea that it's intrinsically about this kind of magical worlds, and which I also do a lot, right? Like, I'm not saying this is bad. It's just more like, I think that's what people assume it is about. Like, this is medium where you whimsical creatures and magic and that, and which is true. But then I think what I am currently actually really interested in, and I see a lot of people doing this, and it really, I feel like this is a great generation of directors now working, especially in the independent animation scene on the festival circuit, telling stories about now, about like us here and now, like the people that we live in, the structure that we live in, and the political environments we were socialized in, but using animation as a way to unearth, I don't know, magical realism, or like finding ways to talk about it, that because animation invites this kind of magicalness, to talk about it in a way where it's also showing you experience that is very held by the poetry of the images, while being grounded in like a social political reality. I know a lot of words chained together, but I think there's something in there. Like, I think the things that excite me, for example, I just saw a film I talk about this film like a lot lately, by Vinny Bosse.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Sulemani, I think. Let me check.
Yeah.
That I'm not misquoting this film. It's a stop motion and 2D animation film made in France. And Vinny is, I think she studied at La Poudrière, and it's a film about coming from India and being in France, and how this kind of sense of belonging and not belonging, and trying to make new connections, and how your memories of your past spill into the now, how all of this happens in the smallest of moments. And it's just about the character going to a restaurant, basically. And she uses this medium, I think, in a way, like it's a mix of stop motion and 2D animation. She switches the mediums for the memories and the now between stop motion and 2D, and the way these are color graded and stuff. Something happens through the technique of animation that I think you couldn't really do in live action. Not because it is whimsical and fantastical, but because the way the images create emotion inside of you just by the technique that they are made in, and by the beauty of the images, that I think it tells something very profound and very deep. And I think people to see this in animation.
Mm-hmm.
It is a medium to invent and to recontextualize the world, and also to be utopian thinkers and to invent realities that are worth striving for. And I find it a very powerful medium. And I think people are using it really beautifully at the moment. So I'm just very happy to be part of this. Like, it's really cool.
Yeah. It definitely gives certain aspects and memories like a additional Verfremdungseffekt. It makes it maybe more easier to watch certain things that you watch.
Yeah.
Keep thinking of, I mean, it's been ages, but like of Persepolis.
Of course, yeah.
And obviously Waltz with Bashir was another one. I mean, but those have been like ages ago. So, I mean, it'd be really great to see more of this coming from a new wave of filmmakers. The final question was going to be, what can you share about, you know, which project you're working on or will be working on next? But obviously we talked about that. Currently, you're going back and forth between Berlin and London. Do you feel like you have enough time to work on your project? Is that like something that you think for this year you'll be able to sort of stick to?
That's my mission for the year. Like, I'm so fortunate that I get to do so many, both like commissioned projects, but also like the last years I've traveled a lot for festivals and being invited to lectures. And especially like last year was really special for me. Like, I had like a retrospective at the Annecy Festival, and I got to speak at really big, on really big stages in front of a lot of people. And I felt really welcomed somehow. And I felt like I arrived somewhere. I felt like, okay, like I always felt like I was late, and I always felt like I had to prove myself in this world of animation and filmmaking where I didn't study any of it. And I had was like this, I need to, I don't know, pay my dues. And I felt so, I don't know, I felt really happy how this community embraced me over the past years. And I think the only downside of it is that you have no time. Like, I was never home last year. I was like,
wow.
I came home for 2 days and I left again. And I think I'm really yearning for almost like the boring routine of just going through finishing a project. And this is the idea. I'm already canceling gigs and making time for this, because I also, now that I'm 32, I somehow...
Wow.
No. I'm not saying this, I'm so old. It's just like, I'm realizing my time is very valuable because I want to do certain things. And I think if I really want to do them, I need to prioritize them. And I think I'm learning that.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the theme of this conversation, is that I feel like there's a lot of stuff that is part of this being a director or whatever that are outside of the actual work, which are a lot about like, how do you make choices? What do you plan for? What do you embrace? What do you get excited for? And I think it's very hard to navigate because that's such an invisible task. Like, you just see somebody made a film, like, wow, you made a film. But to get to make this film, they had to do 5,000 other steps before that are completely invisible.
Yeah.
And I think this I really learned in the last 2-3 years. It's like I need to be resilient against the allure of beautiful opportunities, which I'm very thankful for. But
yeah,
it can be almost a misfortune if you get a certain kind of opportunity too early because it distracts you. I think you recommended to me last time we talked, Talk Easy by Sam Fragoso.
Yes, I did.
And I've since become a super fan. I've listened to everything.
Yeah.
I think it's an amazing project. And he had Richard Linklater on. And Richard Linklater talked to Sam about Sam wanting to make films. I think they talked about it before the podcast.
Yeah.
And then Sam, I think he's like roughly my age. And Richard Linklater said like, yeah, you know, the fact that you're really good at this podcast might also be bad for you or something like this. If you want to make films, you have to commit to them. And the fact that you are really great at doing a podcast, you will have to make a choice at some point. And I think this is, when he said, I really felt it. I was like, oh, wow, yeah, I can totally relate.
Yeah.
Like, it's beautiful. And I'm very thankful for all of these opportunities. If I want to look back in a couple of years of what I've done this year, I think I want this year to be the year where I do this film. So I think, yeah, that's the resolution of all of this.
Okay. So I'm crossing my fingers that you'll have a little bit of day-to-day boredom and routine this year.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope so too. Thank you.
That was it. Thank you so much for sitting down with us, Raman. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much for your time.
Deep Dive Genre is produced by German Films, the National Information and Advisory Center for the Promotion of German Films Worldwide. To find out more about our guests, check out the links in our show notes. To stay up to date with our episodes, subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
Free audio post-production by Alphonic.com.